everybody. This is William Del Pilar. This is the Red, White, and Rude, where pop culture and politics intersect, and I break it down for you. Now, we don't always talk about politics and pop culture. Sometimes it's just talking about pop culture, but I always manage to bring that angle in. In tonight's show, we're going to talk about some lost icons and their relevance back in their day. We're going to talk about the influencers, how podcasters have become today's new media. And we're also going to talk about, we're going to have some quick hits, as there is a Neil Gaiman, Mr. Sexual Assaulter, allegedly, update. Okay, so first off, Mr. Ron Eli Tarzan has passed away. Now, many of y'all today may not know who he is. Eli was known for playing, obviously, the role of Tarzan. It was an NBC series. It started the year I was born in 1966 and ran for a couple of seasons. And the reason I'm well aware of this is because some of the younger members of our audience may not realize, but because of streaming and how streaming's revolutionized everything. But there was a time when syndication was big. Excuse me. Get my coffee here. When syndication was big. And there were original series that were seen through syndication back in the late 90s. But prior to that, all these old shows that went off the air would get syndicated. You're talking Saturday afternoon TV, television, say at 7 o'clock at night before the major networks came on at 8 o'clock. But Ron Eli, he was known for Tarzan. He also, as you can sit there and see, played Doc Savage, the Man of Bronze. There are some great shots there of Tarzan. He was actually, I think he was like 6'4", or, you know, and he was built. And this was the era, remember, the 60s, where weightlifting was not the norm. It was truly the exception, and they were all steroid-taking fools. So he was a pretty buff guy for his day, and he just passed away, 86 years old, in La Jolla, California. Is what my research, that's right down the road. Well, not right down the road, but I go off of there. I live about 30 minutes away from there, an hour away on traffic, hour and a half away on traffic when I've gone to dive during rush hour. I have to head on down there for some night diving. If you're a scuba diver and you never night dive, you're missing out. But anyway, you know, so what his series did, it was a pop culture phenomenon because it was Tarzan on television. And what made it unique was he was articulate. He could speak. He was educated. Instead of the "me Tarzan, you Jane" type format. And that's because the premise of the show was he had gone back to England and got tired of England and went back to Africa, which is how some of the recent movies have portrayed it. So it was also popular because of the exotic locations. And I enjoyed the storylines as a kid, you know. He, as I said, you can see his physique there. You can see it there. You can see it there, his age. He aged pretty well, to be quite honest. You know, so he did his own stunts. Over 24 injuries, including 2 broken shoulders, and you probably would never guess it, but lion bites. I guess all those battles. There's a famous iconic shot of Edgar Burroughs fighting the lions, a painting. I can't remember where I saw it. Well, I couldn't find it, but here's an iconic shot of the Pulp magazine era. And so it's no surprise when I read that he was injured by lions. People don't realize that Edgar Rice Burroughs was writing these novels as Tarzan became famous, a very famous character, you know. So what this did in the 60s, it also helped keep Tarzan relevant. You know, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, there were tons, too many dozens of Tarzan movies, ranging from Johnny Weissmuller to an ex-football player right before Ron Eli took the role. So it influenced pop culture. It inspired merchandise, comics, and even parodies in other media. Now, Ron Eli did suffer a tragedy. His wife, Valerie, was killed by their son in 2019, and his son had some kind of brain disease, some kind of brain trauma or some brain issue, and that's what they attributed that to it. So rest in peace, Ron Eli. Led a wonderful life up to, lived up to the ripe old age of 86, born 1938, passed away 2024. And it's been a tough week. You know, as a Latino growing up, I remember Fernando Valenzuela and Fernando Mania. He passed away, born 1960, passed away 2024. He was only 63, you know. So he created, for those of you not aware, he created Fernando Mania right in the very early 80s. His story, I mean, it's broken English. He grew up in Mexico. He was discovered by a Dodgers scout who was looking at another player and then signed by the Dodgers in 79. He won the National League Cy Young his rookie year, led the Dodgers to a World Series win, led the National League with 8 shutouts, finished 11-25 games started, led the league in strikeouts. But more importantly, he increased Latino community engagement in baseball. Latinos had been playing since the 50s, but now they're considered a norm. In fact, they have actually become the second dominant culture in Major League Baseball. And he helped create that pathway, that door, open that door. He completely changed the perceptions of international players in the majors. He made 6 All-Star teams. He threw a no-hitter in 1990. He was nicknamed El Toro for his durability. And his number 34 was retired by the Dodgers last year. The first Dodger who is not in the Hall of Fame to have his number retired. I mean, this guy did it all in terms of he was a workhorse, and that's why he was named El Toro. You know, and I remember him in the early 80s. I was still in my teenage years, and it was wonderful to see somebody like him. I didn't relate to him as a Latino as much. I was always American first, and I related more to Roberto Duran in boxing, but I took note of Fernando Mania. Everybody did, and God bless him again. 1960 to 2024, helped break the door open for international players, which have become commonplace in the league. So, another death. I mean, that's 2 deaths. Another one that happened maybe a week or so ago is Mike Newman. He was from Baywatch from 1989 to 2001. Now, I'll be honest. I never watched Baywatch. Even, I mean, it spawned. David Hasselhoff made him a superstar worldwide, Pamela Anderson. And then he had Mike Newman. He was always in the backside. He passed away 1956 to 2024. He 68 years old. What made him special, he was in 150 episodes, but he was the only cast member with actual lifeguarding experience. And after the show ended and he went to Hawaii, retired, enjoyed the fruits of a hard life. I don't mean hard as in he struggled. He just had a tough life in the sense of the what he took on, a lifeguard, an actor, and a fireman all at the same time. And in his retirement years, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in 2006. He battled the disease for 18 years. There was a special on Hulu, and I saw one episode on it that dealt with Baywatch, and it was one focusing on him. How he kept pushing himself every day because he knew the next day he may not be able to do what he did that current day. He knew his days were numbered. He died due to heart complications related to Parkinson's. I had to double check to make sure I was recording. But what I found fascinating about him is he was a full-time firefighter with the Los Angeles County Fire Department during his entire run on Baywatch, whereas every other actor I've ever read on has dropped whatever they were doing because they're making good money. They don't have to do that hard work anymore. He loved it. He continued working as a firefighter for 25 years after Baywatch ended. He retired as a captain from the LA County Fire Department. Well, maybe that 25 years was in total. I can't remember, but the point is he had a career 25 years as a firefighter. You know, unlike other cast members, his primary gig was firefighting. The acting was secondary. People don't realize he was a background actor. He was a regular, but always in the background, and his role kind of grew. That's what my research showed. Again, I was fascinated with the fact of his day job. Acting was the side gig, you know? So, and after Baywatch ended, he returned to firefighting full time until his retirement. So what's marvelous or remarkable rather about this is that's a demanding career, a firefighter, and the time frames to act, you know, and that sets him apart and highlighted his dedication to public service. It doesn't matter if he did it because he loved being a firefighter. That showed his love for public service as well as the entertainment industry. So, you know, rest in peace, Mike Newman Newman, Baywatch, 1956 to 2024. And Baywatch was a pop culture phenomena. Wow. I mean, it was huge. Well, who think TNA could become that popular worldwide? I mean, look at him, too. The man is in shape. Not the most handsome fellow there with that receding hairline, but there's no doubt the man was just a stud there. So here's one that just happened very, very recently, and I added it on, and that's Ms. Terry Garr, comedic genius and MS spokesperson. So you see this picture here. I don't know if you see my cursor. That was from Young Frankenstein, as that shot there is. That was one of her early shots. You can see she was rocking too. She was very cute, very cute. She was a girl next door look. But in that, you know, she lived Terry Garr, 1944 to 2024, 78 years old, she lived to be. Her parents, Eddie Garr and Phyllis Lind, one was a vaudeville comedian, the other one was a rocket dancer. So she came from an entertainment family. She started as a dancer in Elvis Presley films, uncredited. Her first speaking role was Head in 1968, featuring the Monkees. I'm a believer. I can't see. But the Monkees were a pop culture phenomenon in the 60s. She was in Batman, Star Trek, Sunday Share Comedy Hour. You know, Batman was another pop culture phenomenon. Star Trek as well. And they both exist today in various forms or fashions. So her breakthrough year was 1974 in a Francis Ford Coppola film. You know, Francis Ford Coppola is very well known for the Godfather movies. But what was her massive breakout film was Young Frankenstein. That's that one right here in the color one you see on top. And I was, you know, I was just, oh my gosh. I was thinking of girls at that age. I think I was 8, 10. So I had my little crush on her. And I've never laughed so hard in the scene with Gene Wilder. He's looking at the door. My God, what matters? Why, thank you, doctor. I mean, the timing, that was Gene Wilder's dream project. He wrote and directed it, and he was always attached to Mel Brooks. I don't know if he directed it. Maybe Mel Brooks directed it, but that was, he was always attached to Mel Brooks, but I know he wrote it. And that was Young Frankenstein. She also had a major role in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Steven Spielberg, 1977. That was a massive blockbuster. She was nominated for Best Supporting Actress for Tootsie in 1982. She was in Oh God. Oh God was with John Denver and George Burns. Again, in the late 70s, big, big, massive blockbuster hits. She did serious acting with The Black Stallion, late 70s. She was in the 80s. She was Mr. Mom with Michael Keaton, played a secondary role. But the point is her heyday was in the 70s, 80s, but she was everywhere. She had great timing. She actually, for those of you who are younger, she had her role in Friends as Phoebe's mother. Now, here's what people may not realize is she was really on David Letterman a lot in Letterman's early show, the first few years, and he credits her with helping develop that show, getting it and making it popular, and the reason, you know, creating the foundation of it. But, you know, she did have her health challenges. She was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 1983. She hid it for years until she couldn't no longer. And the reason she hid it, she didn't think she'd get any roles. People thought it was destined. Growing up, I thought it was. But now, as we know, MS, you can live for years and years and be productive. She also had a brain aneurysm in 2006. She retired from acting in 2011 and had a phenomenal career. I'm sure she did her parents proud. Correct, she was adopted too. But Terry Garr, 1944 to 2024. Rest in peace. It's been a sad week for people of my era from the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s. But this also shows how fleeting fame is. I mean, who? Most of my audience who are young, y'all don't even know who Ron Eli is. You know, you may have heard of Fernando Mania, but have no clue. And obviously, Whoopi Goldberg's probably somebody, or not Whoopi Goldberg, Terry Garr, somebody who you guys look at and go, she looks familiar. She looks familiar. You know, and obviously Michael Newman with Baywatch. So it shows how fleeting fame is. And even superstars, you know, Cary Grant. Yes, somebody who Cary Grant is today, they won't know. He was the Tom Cruise of his era and for many years. But times change, people move on, tastes move on, different forms of entertainment. And I don't necessarily mean in the types of entertainment, but how it's delivered. And we're so fragmented. But these were superstars, you know, maybe not Eli or Terry Garr, but they were big stars too. So rest in peace to you, all of you. You made an impact, and thank you for making my life as a child enjoyable to watch TV, making me laugh, for making my heritage become more prominent. And I don't really have much to say about Baywatch, boy, but they make TNA popular worldwide. But for Mike Newman, for bringing eloquence and honor and honesty to a role, and maintaining and never forgetting who you were. And that's really important. All right, let us move on. Let's talk about pop culture and the changing landscape of political media. As you can see with this image I have, there's Joe Rogan. There's, I forget what this one's called, the Alex Cooper, Call Her Daddy, the chick showing the cleavage there. Obviously, Theo Vaughn on the bottom right there, Logan Paul, the top right, Bussin' with the Boys there in the middle, top, and All the Smoke. Or is it? Maybe I'm flipping those two around. I don't know those two anyway. It's just in my research, I was just researching how new media has overtaken traditional campaigning for politics. And why is that? So why are political candidates shifting to new media, to these podcasters, to find voters? Well, first of all, the trust in media is at an all-time low of 34%. It's biased. It's leftist. And nobody watches them. That represents a significant decline from 40% in 2022 and 44% in 2021. In the late 90s, it was at 53%. That was the last time it was above 50. In 1997, it was above 50%, showing the decline. So it's gone, oh my gosh, in about almost 30 years, it's dropped from 53 to 34. Almost 20%. I mean, we just don't trust it. I don't follow it. It's a joke. You know, there's a partisan divide. Only 7% of Republicans express trust in the media. 35% of independents report that trust, and with 68% of Democrats enjoying traditional media. Why? Because it leans hard left. It doesn't lean left. It is hard left. So we've given up on it, as have others. So, obviously, the increased polarization has created this mistrust, the spreading of information, or as we like to say, fake news. I mean, and I haven't even talked about newspapers. The New York Times and the Washington Post have really taken massive hits as well. The New York Times is through tens of millions put into marketing and buying other companies such as Athletic. They've slowly started they got the greatest subscription model out of all these print papers, but they are very hard left too. So people don't like that. People, and even today in this race, me Latinos and a lot of Blacks are like, enough of thinking we're stupid. So enter podcasters, the shift towards alternative platforms. Politicians increasingly are turning to podcasters and social media for direct communication because that's what we're listening to. And it gives unfiltered access. Right now, Kamala Harris will not go on Joe Rogan because Joe Rogan won't concede to having questions given to her. And the ones I interviewed, Bustin' with the Boys, All the Smoke, and Alice Cooper, which is Call Her Daddy, they were talking. This is what you can ask her. This is how long she can do it, et cetera, et cetera. Joe Rogan has none of that nonsense. Theo Vaughn has none of that nonsense. You know, Logan Paul, it was conversations. So Trump, President Trump, former President Trump was able to do it well. Vice President Kamala Horizontal Harris, as I call her for various reasons, don't believe me, talk to Willie Brown. You know, and you'll know why I call her that. She struggled with it. But at the end of the day, this is a new forum. You're going to see candidates able to adapt to this much, much better than Trump has. And Kamala's a joke, and she struggled with it. So, but this is the future. Now, why are these politicians going to these platforms? Well, it's easy. Let's start from the top. Joe Rogan, about 50.9 million followers. He's like the number one podcast in like 90 or 91 countries. You know, before YouTube cut off access to the interview, in just a couple of days, he had 34 million. Then they made it tough to find, and just now, recently, they put it back up. But in a few days, he got 34 million views. Then there's Alex Cooper, which is Call Her Daddy, some kind of sex show. She's only got 6.5 million compared to 51 million for Rogan. So you're seeing the disparity. But at 6.5 million, the potential there to reach more than traditional cable network now is there. So Rogan interviewed Donald Trump. Alex Cooper interviewed Kamala Harris. Then there's Theo Vaughn, who has about 5.5 million. He interviewed Donald Trump. He's a comedian. He's sitting in that liberal crowd who sees the reality for what it is and understands how the world works and are smart enough to watch these interviews and be swayed by what the candidates say. Whereas the Alex Cooper, that was Kamala talking to her own base, young women there. Then there's Logan Paul, who is does Impulsive. He's got 25 million followers. He interviewed Donald Trump. Big, 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 big numbers there. Then there's Bustin' with the Boys, 1.2 million, and All the Smoke, 1.5 million. They both interviewed Kamala. Now, why did Kamala go to these smaller bases? She had no choice. She went after some gamers. There's one gamer at 30 million, and there's others with 10 million when you combine their platforms. They want nothing to do with her. They don't even see her as black, some of these influencers. I don't blame them. You know, I did my research. But that's not what I'm here to talk about. But she struggled to get these individuals who have any interest in even talking to her. So the disparity is there. Why? Because conservatives have fled and are more apt to be listening to new media than indoctrinated leftists. I do mean that for the simple fact that they believe the what they're told. So the indoctrination is baked in. You know, so her, whereas conservatives are all over new media. Progressives are slowly getting there. Now, you compare the podcasters to traditional media viewership. Fox News, about 2 million viewers on average per show. MSNBC, 1.4 million. CNN, 850,000. Now, CNN, they had listeners as shows as low as 60,000 viewers. You know, same thing with MSNBC, a couple hundred thousand. Fox is a pretty steady one with about 2.5 million per every show, with some shows doing a little better, some shows doing a little worse. For example, The Five, 3.3 million viewers. Jesse Waters, 3 million. Gutfeld, 2.8 million. And I think Trump's done all of those shows. Then there's Deadline White House with Nicole Wallace, 1.8 million. So, I mean, there are a million viewers behind. And that they're talking to the... Kamala goes on there. She's already talking to people who are going to vote for her. She's not going to make a change, any difference. Anderson Cooper, what a joke. 915,000 total viewers. The guy gets paid like $10 million per year. It's disgusting over there. So what are the advantages for this new media? Well, they bypass traditional media scrutiny. They reach younger, more diverse audiences. They control their message and narrative more effectively in a conversational tone, and they create more personal and authentic connections. Trump's interview with Rogan was one of the best you'll ever see Trump. And Rogan didn't push back as much as he was Joe Rogan. He wasn't conforming to him. So This emphasis on digital social media strategies has its reasons. And again, it's the future. And there's more shareable content that can be seen and more viral moments. So what's the issue with traditional media? They're going to struggle to maintain relevance. You know, they're going to have to shift from cable to social media. But as we saw in the gaming industry with G4 trying to do it, it just didn't work. So what's the implication for this? Well, as we know, there's a decline in mainstream media. So again, there's a declining trust in the mainstream media, and they're not reaching the voter base as these politicians want them to. So that, again, is why these politicians are doing this. And you're going to see a push in the future towards a more charismatic politician. And, you know, the potential for more polarized and fragmented political discourse is there, because this will break down into the his and hers, and what will be, meaning the his and hers, meaning the conservative and the liberal. And what will have to happen is they're going to have to go to some of the podcasters on the other side, because you can influence the vote. There's a lot of young people who are listening to these shows and can be influenced, whereas on cable media, tends to skew older than they know their audience and the numbers of the younger demographics. So, for example, Anderson Cooper may get 915,000, but he's only getting a couple hundred thousand in the demographic whose minds can be changed. So we're seeing the blurring of political journalism and entertainment news. In a way, is it blurring as much as we haven't had real journalism since the turn of the century, when Gore tried to steal the 2000 election, and he did. I know people involved in there, and they said they had to stop the counting because it'd be a straight mark, and they were claiming it as a Democrat vote, and the liberal justices were siding with them. And so the Republicans were like, we got to stop this counting. And they did so successfully to keep the fraudulent votes. Now, that's change. And obviously, there are many red flags that aren't discussed, because it's seen as taboo, because of the leadership did not want Trump from the Republican Party, and obviously Democrats didn't. But my point is simple. We haven't had fair journalism since the turn of the century. You know, and here's a final caveat on this, is non-traditional interviewers, such as Joe Rogan's, the Theo Vaughn's, they just have conversations, and they can ask different type of questions. You know, you actually see more reality in terms of what the real Donald Trump than you do with other interviews. Kamala Harris has struggled everywhere. Her first real interview did not happen until a week ago. We are a week away from the election, and about a week ago, she had her first actual interview. It wasn't even a tough interview. They just, Fox News, Brett Baer just answered the questions nobody else wanted. And then they hated on them. But then she went into friendly grounds with Anderson Cooper in town hall, and he just answered basic questions too, and she couldn't answer them, and they all attacked him. So you're going to see a slow progression with the Democrats as they cling to traditional media because it's a mouthpiece for them. You know, so we'll see how it all pans out, but you're going to need to be charismatic, such as myself. Hey, I'm an elected official formerly. I thought maybe I'm going to run again, because I don't take, yo soy Latino. And as a conservative Latino, I take no trash, man. Oh, but you're seeing this complete change of traditional media than cable, and now cable giving way to new media in the form of podcaster. So it's an evolving media landscape, and it's fundamentally, as Obama likes to say, it's fundamentally changing, or as I like to say, altering how politicians talk and communicate with we, the voters, how campaigns are run, how political information is disseminated and consumed. By disseminated, for those of you who aren't familiar with the word, means how it's spit out. And the record low trust in the mainstream media is the driving force behind all of this. And I, for one, am happy about it. So let us move on. I want to talk what I call this segment, quick hits. Happenings in pop culture, some updates and short takes. Harvey Weinstein, Hollywood's former top dog and friends with A-listers, such as all the women with the Me Too movement. Half of them slept with him, knowing that he'd give them good parts. You know, well, my hands, see, with him, William, no, they didn't. there are things I have done in life that have not helped my family financially or helped me move up the corporate ladder because I refused to do them. These women who slept with Weinstein, they had a choice. Weinstein's a pig, he's a dog, and he's paying the price for what he did. But these women had a choice. So don't ever tell me they had no choice. We all have choices in life. Sometimes, many times, we don't take the hard choice because we want the payout. Show me the money. Give me fame. I want to have adulation. Then I want to grift Gwyneth Paltrow off my fans. That woman. There's some people who sell farts online. How the hell do you sell your farts? I don't know, but you can buy a little canister of them. Oh, some weird ass people out there. So, Harvey Weinstein, guy's a physical wreck, man. He was diagnosed with chronic myeloid leukemia. That's a rare form of bone marrow cancer. The guy's in prison serving time at Rikers. He's already been hospitalized for COVID-19, suffered double pneumonia, underwent emergency heart surgery. He did have one of his guilty verdicts overturned, and it was cited of improper testimonies as reason for overturning. It's what they try to do with Bill Cosby. You know, just brought people who weren't involved. They kind of made it to where they were going to get that guilty, even if they had to cheat to do it. And that's kind of what they did. But they're not letting it go. He's facing retrial. And that starts sooner than later, in a week or two from now. He's also appealing a 2020 conviction in L.A. You know, he's serving a 16-year sentence for rape in an L.A. case. So this guy has massive issues. He's going to die in prison. But that's an update on Weinstein. He's a physical wreck now, has leukemia. I don't feel bad for him. Maybe that's karma. I'm not saying he deserved it. Do not get me wrong. What I'm saying is maybe it's karma, you know, whatever. But his life is in the – he's gone from living large to living the worst life possible. P. Diddy may be joining him soon. So there's also news from Sylvania and the Chuck star. Oh, actually, I'm sorry. Hold on one second. You may remember Zachary Levi from his Shazam role. He also played in Chuck. He's conservative, and he's come out of the closet. He encourages closeted conservatives in Hollywood to publicly express their political views. And he says it's now or never. Now or never. And he got a lot of backlash from lies that Whoopi Goldberg said. You know, Goldberg stated that, oh, no, Hollywood is a conservative, too. Yeah, there are lots and lots of conservatives, thousands. There are millions of actors out there. And you can probably name 10 to 15 conservatives that you know of. Everybody else is leftist. So he responded to her. He disagreed with her. And she can only name two Republican actors, John Boyd and Dennis Quaid. And somebody had to help her with Dennis Quaid. You know, so he says that Republicans are scared to speak out. You know, there's the iconic image. And for the record, Shazam did very well at the box office. But what happened, Shazam 2 kind of went woke. When you go woke, you go broke. So, you know, he was collecting a check, I guess, there. Yeah, there's another shot of him. There you go. There's a good one there of him. But, you know, he suggests that many conservatives are afraid to speak out, and that is true. Kelsey Grammer, conservative, has stated that. And he said that many have sent him messages expressing their fear about publicly supporting Trump. But this is why they win. This is why the left wins. You know, some of the conservatives out there that you may have heard of, or we assume they're conservative, even though they haven't directly stated as such. Clint Eastwood. Remember, he spoke to the invisible chair. I mean, Obama was pretty much invisible. Whether you like it or not, you may not want to hear this, but Obama answered to the same donor masters. That's right. I said it. Donor masters as George Bush, Bill Clinton, or anybody else did. Kevin Sorbo's world. You know, people make fun of Kevin Sorbo's. The guy had worldwide fame. Every person knew him because he was Hercules. Dean Cain, another one, syndication with Superman. Kirk Cameron had one of the biggest shows in the 80s. What the hell was that show called? What the hell was that show called? Growing Pains. That's it. Growing Pains. Then there's Rob Schneider of SNL fame, comedian, had his own little run of movies. And now Zachary Levi. So there's not a lot that we can go to. You know, he endorsed Trump during an event for RFK Jr. And Tulsi Gabbard was there, too. And he initially supported RFK Jr., but switched his endorsement to Trump after RFK Jr. suspended his campaign. You know, so there you have it, folks. Another conservative out of the closet. All right. So let's give you a good Neil Gaiman update, Mr. Alleged Sexual Assaulter, who has paid off his women on those sexual assaults. Now, all this is alleged, as you can see, not the most handsome looking guy. But anyway, one of his creations is Good Omens. And it's had a couple season run, and it's going to conclude with one last episode. So, and this decision follows Gaiman's controversy, and he's the show's co-creator and author of the original novel. Again, the man's a brilliant writer, but he's a leftist pig. You know, he's been accused of sexual assault by two women in the podcast, and other women have come out. One is a 23-year-old nanny who, with the alleged incident occurring in New Zealand in 2022. Gaiman was in his 60s. The guy's a freak. This is what happens. Men with power. Come here. You want me because I'm Neil Gaiman? Oh, no, you're old, scraggly, and wrinkly. And you need a blue pill to help you out. I'm just saying that. I don't know if that's true. But another accuser identified as Kay claimed non-consensual encounters when she was 20 and Gaiman was in his 40s. So he has a history of this. And let's be honest. Once you do this, you're going to keep doing it until somebody says enough. And it looks like that's where we could be at. Again, all of this is alleged. He's denied the allegations. The kicker is he says these were all consensual. They all said yes, Mr. Judge. Well, a lot of times they do because they feel if they don't, they're going to get fired or they're going to get cracked on because he's Neil Gaiman. He's in the power position. I tell you, I was going to say a story. But I can't. It was humorous, but there's nothing humorous about this. It's humorous because when guys have it happen to them, we don't care. Yeah. So all this has led to some of his screen adaptations being halted or suspended. That includes The Dead Boy Detectives canceled after one season. Obviously, Good Omens third season production was paused. Now it's one episode. The Graveyard Book was put on hold. I don't think that was due to Gaiman, but the point is, perception is reality. You know, so some fans, I'm disappointed. Really, if it was Trump, you're like, hey, put him in jail. But when it comes to your boy, Neil Gaiman, I'm disappointed. So I don't know how this is going to affect him long term. But right now, he's persona non grata. People are distancing themselves from it. And that's your Neil Gaiman Good Omens update. And that comes from a podcast I did some moons ago. It was a previous Red, White, and Rude episode. You should check it out. There we go. I found it. It was episode 21 of the Red, White, and Rude. This is episode 23. So it's a couple episodes back. You can check it out. I'll tell you at the end of the show. But that's your Neil Gaiman's update. And I talked about that earlier. So let's remove him. And let's go to our final topic of the night. She, he, it. I always joke. Yeah, my pronouns. I am and. I am is the first one. You're God. I just like to piss people off. But the Mass Effect board game pronoun predicament. Big and race Bader Eric Land has a vajayjay moment. So Matt, there's a new Mass Effect board game. The Mass Effect is an extremely uber popular game. And it's based off the very popular computer game, or I'm sorry, just game. Xbox, PlayStation, whatever, you know what I'm talking about. I'm a gamer, so I think I played the iPad version of it. There was an iPad story to it, if I remember correctly. But it's uber popular. It's called Priority Hagalaz. It's been designed by Eric Lang for my research. And there's the inclusion of pronouns. Now, fans have been critical of this because they say, hey, that's unnecessary, and it's politically motivated, which it is. And they're also viewing it as an attempt to retroactively implement modern identity politics into the Mass Effect universe. And again, they are absolutely correct. So there's been a fan backlash. And because of that, fans don't want anything to do with it. And it's ruined the game for them. So they've given it one stars. Enter Eric Lane. He calls critics, and I'm going to quote this, calls critics fucking man babies on social media. He encourages followers to leave positive reviews to counter negative reviews. So he doesn't care about the quality of the game. He wants you to lie. Just say, it's a great game. It's a great game, whether you played it or not. In their defense, if the he, she affects you that much, the pronouns, and it does hurt you for playing the game, then yeah, put that, but specifically state it, you know. But to me, okay, do you enjoy the game? I'm playing Silent Hill 2, the remake, right now. I haven't told my wife I bought it yet. She's like, why are you staying up till 2? And no, I'm kidding. But there's some woke aspects of it, but it's such a classic game, and the storyline's so good, and it's literally a complete remake of it. You know, I'm looking at the game, and the couple of woke issues don't bother me. But when you make that the primary issue, as they may or may not have done here in this game, that does piss and upset people. So, again, he's encouraged followers to leave positive reviews, and he's accused of trying to game the board game geek system. And he deleted his man baby's post, but the internet is forever. Now, here's the kicker. There are reports of accounts being banned for one-star ratings for this game. And that's wrong, too, by the company to do that. So, and why do people believe that that's happening? It went from 52 one-star ratings to 8 after the removals. So account bans are happening. Who is Eric Lang? Well, he's got quite a resume, to be quite honest. He's done a lot. But he's known for being political and having politically charged statements. He's described, and I researched him, he is a race baiter. I guess he's biracial or something like that. So he used that side. And you know what? God bless him. We all do. I'm Latino. I never cared that anybody knew I was Latino. But you want to play race game? Yo soy Latino. Vete a carajo, idiota. Porque yo no juego tu juego. I'm like, I'm Latino. Go to hell. I don't play your games. My grandmother was called the N-word. All my relatives are brown. My head was jerked back. Eyes, oye, China, ¿por qué tiene ojo azul? ¿Por qué tan blanco? Asking my mom, why his eyes blue? Why he's so white? And then they joke, is he yours? We never cared. You know, I play to this day. I love my relatives down in Panama. We go back and forth. It's nothing but love, you know? So when people play these silly games, I'm like, hey, I can get into it too. But you don't want me all over you because I don't hold back. You can't sit there and say racist to me. I won't play that crap. So he's a race baiter per my research. He's accused of being one of the worst diversity hire agitators in the board game field. And he's made comments about how great Black Lives Matter, despite the fact that tens of millions have been gone. They don't know where. They haven't paid taxes. Some have been arrested. One got whacked, I think, by a cop after she charged him with a knife. He made controversial statements in a now deleted interview. See, and when they delete these interviews, when they delete these comments, it's because they're getting backlash and the pushback because they've been busted lying for whatever. So he's seen as part of a cabal of woke activists in the board game industry and the gaming industry. It doesn't end. And for you people out there, and I keep saying this, it is uber important you watch what your kids are playing. The gaming industry is probably the biggest tool that woke use to indoctrinate your child. More people game than go to the movies now. A AAA game that is successful will sell 600 million to a billion in a week compared to Hollywood big tent movies. Luckily for us, big tent AAA games are failing. Concord, one that was put out by EA Sports, or not Sports, but EA, 8 years in the making, they're like $300 million. Boom, tank. They pulled it after 9 days. I suspect they pulled it because they wanted to be able to qualify for the tax write-off. You know, there's another one, Dragon Age. I have the first 2 or 3 games. The newest one is completely woke. It openly talks about transitioning, changing. Do not let your children play that game. It's a completely woke game for one purpose, to indoctrinate you. Hopefully it falls on its face. It should. Watch what your kids play. And there you have it, my friends. That is tonight's show. And man, did we cover a lot. Rest in peace to Ron Eli, Mike Newman, Terry Garr, Fernando Valenzuela, I hope you enjoyed my take on why podcasters are the new form of new media for political campaigns and what that means in the future. And obviously some of these quick takes I had here. But you can find this podcast and episode 21 based off my Neil Gaiman update. You can hear what I said about Neil Gaiman in the Red, White, and Rude episode 21. You can find that podcast, my conservative podcast, Fired Up. You can find Libertarian podcast. You can find Pure Play Sports podcast, all at grumbliesmedia.com, as well as our social media platforms, YouTube, Rumble, Apple, Spotify, and Pandora. Until next time, my friends, I am William Del Pilar. This is the Red, White, and Rude, and I bid you adieu.